I'm so glad that I can look out, and for the most part, I know just about everybody. We're all friends here tonight, because this is one of those very, very challenging parts of the gospel that I'm not sure in any way I have a final answer on. I think I've just begun to scratch the surface of what's going on in this tax trap that is set before Jesus. But I'm going to do my best to try to lead us in a way that will get us to think about the tension we live in between Caesar's kingdom and God's kingdom as we encounter this very, very interesting story. Of course, Jesus is embroiled in controversies. This is his last week of life. It's in Jerusalem. It's during Passover season. We've already seen him wield a number of debates and win them all. So you get to start wondering why anyone's still debating him. But people continue to do that, thinking that they can best Jesus and trap him, corner him, take away his popular approval. And this is the latest in that, Matthew 22, verse 15. And this one short segment covers politics, money, and religion, which, as far as I understand, those are the three things you're not supposed to talk about in polite company. We heard it during Thanksgiving, you know, don't talk about politics, don't talk about religion is previous, and then don't talk about money if you can help it, particularly if you're talking about taxes. If you add sex to this, you got the perfect storm. It's a grand cavalcade of all the things we're not supposed to talk about in polite company. But I think one of the reasons we're not supposed to talk about them is because those things get at the very core of our personal lives. I mean, you can't live your life without running affront of politics and religion and money and sex. Those become important things. But here we don't have to worry about the sex part. That's wonderful. So just money, politics, and religion. Eventually, you have to talk about these. Eventually, if faith is to hit real life, it's going to have to address things like taxes and politics and religious life and how faith intersects with the kingdoms of this world. How we live faithfully in Caesar's kingdom or in the empire of America that we do. How do we live faithfully? How do we maintain a gospel witness? And that's what Jesus is being challenged with here by some very strange bedfellows. And that's what makes this story so fun. If you read if you follow as I read verse 15, you got two interesting people groups together. Then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him in his words. So there's no question what they're trying to do. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. And that's where it gets interesting. Because the Pharisees and the Herodians have absolutely nothing in common. Except for one thing. They both hate Jesus. Other than that, theologically, politically, they have nothing in common whatsoever. The Pharisees are, for the most part, a lay movement. It's lay people who've decided they need to be devout to the law, committed to Torah, to live that in such a way that they maintain their faithfulness. Where the Herodians are the aristocratic priestly class that, in many ways, they're above the fray of normal human life. They are the ones that are empowered. And they're empowered because they're supporters of Roman occupation. They're in alliance with the Romans. That's why they're called Herodians. They are supporters of Herod Antipas, the enemy of the Jews. So that they are just fine with Roman occupation. It's not a problem for them. They have been helped by it and their life has been improved through this. Whereas the Pharisees want nothing but to keep contact with Rome to the barest minimum. They are separatist. They want to make sure that nothing Gentile touches them and their lives and their faith whatsoever. And of course, Roman life and politics and Roman idolatry are part of that corruption that they would like to keep to a minimum. So, if you wanted to put it into modern day terms, the Pharisees consider themselves the true nationalists. They are the patriots. They are the ones who see themselves as the patriots, and they see the Herodians, and they say they are not patriots. They do not care about our nation. They've compromised it in a major way. The Herodians are the ones saying to the Pharisees, get a grip. Learn to live in this society that we've inherited for better or for worse, and the way forward is just to accommodate yourself to this very bad situation. But really, it's not as bad as you might think, because the Romans are bringing money, they're bringing trade. It's not bad if you can put up with their idolatry, if you can put up with their corruption, and so forth. So you have these two groups, and they are usually at each other's throats. They hate each other. It's much like if you'd put, you know, two diverse groups politically or religiously in the same room, you would, I won't give examples, but you guys can come up with some, where you'd think, why are these groups together? And yet you find that they are arm in arm because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. They have a common enemy. And that common enemy is Jesus. And they are hoping to trap him through a gotcha question. They have some trick questions up their sleeve. And this is one of the best, actually. It's a good trick question. They want to entrap him. They're trained in rhetoric and skilled in argument. So they'd like to put Jesus in an embarrassing position and discredit him altogether. And so, like any smooth trickster, they begin with flattery. Teacher, verse 16, right in the middle, they said, which right away, you're the teacher. Rabbi would be the real word they're using. We know you're a man of integrity, and we know that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then. And then they're going to give the question. But they have this incredible sincerity. I love how that picture kind of gives the sense that, you know, you can see behind the facade that there's something up the sleeve, and yet it's given in such a flowery way. Jesus, you teach God's ways accurately. You're indifferent to popular opinion. You don't pander to people's thoughts. You tell it like it is. So, truth teller, the one who never shies away from controversy. Here's a hot potato. And they hand him this hot potato, and it's in the form of this question. Verse 17, tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? So right away, money, politics, and is it right, religion? Is it lawful? Is it permitted? Is this okay according to what God has told us to live, how to live as the people of God? This isn't the only tax the Jewish people are having to struggle with. It is the annual tax that's paid to Rome, one denarius, a day's wage, every year, paid to support their oppressors. There are other taxes, the temple tax, land tax, customs tax, but this is the tax that is particularly onerous because they're having to pay their oppressors. And I hope you see why this is such a problematic tax for them. They're required to pay in support of their oppressors for the oppression they're receiving, a fee of one denarius a year, a day's wage, which might not seem a lot, but if you're an impoverished people and you're living day by day, as most of them are, that's one whole day that you're giving to your captor, that you're giving to the one whose religion you despise, whose occupation you don't in any way respect. And so you have this occupied people. You can imagine, what would it be like if we woke up tomorrow morning and some foreigners had invaded our country and all of a sudden we're beholden to them and we're told, oh, and by the way, to support our occupation of your country, you'll be paying us a tax every year. And the tax will be a couple $1,000s. I mean, we get hot and hairy over a 30-buck increase. I mean, watch the news. And now you have your occupier and you have to pay them to keep you bound. So, they have a great question. Tell us, what's your opinion? Is it right? Is it lawful? Is it permitted according to Torah to pay taxes to the emperor Caesar or not? And they're hoping to put Jesus on the horns of a dilemma because they know the answer. For them, the answer is, well, we're really going to pay. We've been paying. It's not like Jesus' answer is going to change the way they have lived. They have been paying. They've been forced to pay. If they don't pay, there's a Roman cross awaiting them. I mean, you pay Rome, or Rome will get you. So, they know they're going to have to pay. This, in many ways, is just theoretical, but they know if they can place him on the horns of a dilemma, where he has to either say, yes, it's right, or no, it's right, that neither answer will satisfy anybody. So, he's got two choices. Is it right or is it wrong? If he says, well, yes, it's right to pay taxes, he's siding with the Herodians, who have no problem paying the taxes. They're just fine. They're benefiting from Roman occupation. But then the Pharisees will see him as an unpatriotic traitor, as someone who has lost credibility because he obviously doesn't care about Israel. He's not a true patriot. If he says no, it's not right to pay the taxes. Then the Herodians are going to be troubled and they'll see him as insubordinate to the state. The Pharisees might be happy, but according to the state, he's a dangerous political agitator and he's one that ought to watch out because a cross might be in his future as well. So yes, no, either answer puts him in serious jeopardy and his interlocutors feel that they have him trapped. People do this all the time. If you know logic at all, remember this. It is the logical fallacy of the false dichotomy. It is when you are forced to make an answer in the choice of A or B and no C. Where you're forced to kind of say, yes, I'm this, or no, I'm not. The worst version of that is, when did you last beat your wife? You know, that kind of question that you can't answer in any way without feeling or sensing some guilt. But I get asked all the time, Rich, are you liberal and progressive, or are you conservative? Well, I'm being forced into a false dichotomy. Oh, why do I have to give either answer? In some things I'm liberal, and some things I'm conservative. So what am I? Rich, are you Democrat or Republican? Well, some things I agree with one side and some things I agree with the other side. Why are you feeling that you have to constrain or force me into the logical fallacy of a false dichotomy? As if there's only two answers. As if there's only two possible responses. Sadly, when we get to the most fundamental things like votes, you're forced to that. But in life, you're not. In life, there's a lot of room, there's lots of gray, there's lots of in-between and medians, and it doesn't force you to have to give a yes or no as much as saying, well, yes in this case, no in this case. I could go on and on, but I'll get myself in trouble because I love to play middle of the road. The problem of course, living in the middle of the road is you get run over again and again and again. I mean, it's easier to live in the ditch because no car is going to hit you. But if you're in the middle of the road, you're always getting hit by somebody. But Jesus is going to do something here. He's going to refuse to play the game of false dichotomy. And he's going to thread the needle. He's going to go right down the middle. And he begins his answer very cleverly with a request. Verse 18, Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, "You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me?" So we know as readers, he knows. He's even saying, I know you're trying to put me on the horns of the dilemma. So, show me the coin used for paying the tax. Now, if you really wanted to have some fun with this text, if the Pharisees and Herodians wanted to win this argument, if they'd known what was coming, because I think in their mind, they think he's either got to say yes or no. There's no other choice. If they weren't so sure of themselves, they probably should have refused to give him anything. No, we don't know what you're talking about. We don't have a coin. But instead, they brought him instantly, immediately, they have a Roman denarius. And he asked them, whose portrait is this and whose inscription is on it? So he lifts up the coin, which is not his, but they have immediately at their avail. And he says, there's two things on this coin I'd like you to notice. There's an image, which is a Jewish way of saying an idol. There is an idolatrous representation of something here, which is forbidden according to Jewish law. And secondly, there's an inscription. And what does that inscription say? Now, we're not told in this, but we have through archaeology so many denarii that we have an abundance of them. And if you look at what is inscripted on the front it says, Tiberius Caesar, divine son of Augustus. Or you could literally say, Tiberius Caesar, son of God. He's the son of a god. And then on the back, it says also high priest. So he is Tiberius Caesar, the divine son of God, and high priest. Now, them's fighting words if you're Jewish. There's only one God. And it's not Tiberius Caesar. They have enough trouble with Jesus. But they certainly have real big troubles with Tiberius Caesar. And you have a big problem when you've made this god the high priest of all of the Roman Empire, because the Jews are part of the Roman Empire and they have their own high priest. So you have two things right away as they pull it out. It's as if you were to say, hey, Rich, pull out a pentagram here. Why do you have a pentagram? Well, I like Rush. You would start to wonder what's that doing here in a place of worship, even though you could argue about how innocent that can be and how it has many meanings. I'm trying to think of an even worse one. Pull out a what's that movie we saw with the Billy Goat? A goat's head. I guess you could get, yeah. Anyway, that's another story. These are fighting words. These are fighting words, and these are the reasons during Jesus' boyhood that there were many revolts against Roman occupation. Because they were forced to carry around these idols to pay for things because they were now in Roman occupation. And this is why, just a chapter or two before, we saw Jesus at the temple pulling everything out of the temple. And the problem wasn't that there were money changers, it was another problem. But the reason there are money changers in the temple is because if you're going to make an offering, you have to make it in a kosher coin. And you have to exchange the Roman idolatrous coin for a Jewish kosher coin without idolatry on it and without this heresy that Caesar is the divine Son of God. So there's a reason why the Jews tried to keep as far away of this as possible, and the reasons were that they despised this. Because they despised it so, many of them would end up hanging on Roman crosses as opponents to the Roman way of living. This also happened in AD 66 to 70 when the temple was finally destroyed. A lot of it had to do with Rome wanting to bring its own idols and images and way of life into a Jewish culture. So the reason why Jesus in verse 18, before he even asked for the coin, says, "You hypocrites," is he wants them to know right away that they're the ones with the idol in their pocket. He doesn't have one. He can't pull one out. But they have one ready to go, and he wants to show them they're concerned about piety and devotion, and they want to put them on the horns of the dilemma at the very time that they are carrying about in the temple area this image of Caesar with a declaration that Caesar is the Son of God. If they're that concerned about matters of the law, then perhaps they wouldn't be doing such things. But that leads to the deeper challenge that Jesus gives, and what makes this challenge so difficult to navigate is it's so short and so brief, but I think its brevity is its brilliance, and I want to just go over this with you. Verse 21, they immediately reply, "It's Caesar's portrait, and it's an inscription about Caesar." So then he said to them, a comment that we're all very familiar with, "Render to Caesar that which is Caesar's," is the King James. "And to God that which is God's." Or here, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." There are many ways you could approach this. Lots of ink has been spilt in trying to get at the heart of what Jesus is getting at here. One popular way is to say, if you think of two circles, here's Caesar's domain. And Caesar's domain of wealth and power and violence and might, it is functioned and informed by the coinage of Rome, and thus this is a coin of the realm. And within this circle, you're to give that proper respect and not worry about that. You just do, you know, as in Rome, do as the Romans. There's that portion of life. And then there's perhaps a bigger circle that is God's, and you're to do that which is spiritual in this circle, and never the circles shall meet. It's just, unfortunately, living in the world we live in, sometimes you got to give to Caesar, and sometimes you got to give to God. The problem with both of those ideas, that overarching idea, is God's kind of like this tax gatherer that you just kind of give a little bit to, maybe a little bit more. But Caesar's got to get his due as well. So there's two domains, and you give some to this, you give some to that, I guess the rest is yours. I prefer to come at this saying in a little bit different way. It's an interesting saying because, like any good aphorism, it almost seems like these two parallel lines should be equal, but they are incredibly unequal. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, but when you move on, give to God what is God's, those lines aren't equal anymore because Caesar's role is so vastly inferior to God's. So vastly, infinitely inferior. Because when you think about what is it that belongs to Caesar, well, of course, Caesar always thinks that far more belongs to Caesar than really does. The state always overreaches, always. You know, it always thinks it has more at stake and is in more control and would like to be even in more control. But God, domain, if you will, envelops that domain, exceeds that domain, so that that domain becomes infinitely inferior, which is why you start to say, if we give to Caesar what's Caesar's, that's kind of easy to figure out. You do your taxes, you figure out how much owe, and then you're done. But what does it mean to give to God what is God's? Where does that end? Where do we even put a stop to that? Because the earth is the Lord's and all that is in it. Psalm 24, that's a common song of praise for the Jewish people. The earth is the Lord's. In the Torah, it says, you know, there are domains of land apportioned to the Israelites, but they're constantly told, the land's not yours. It's not yours, it's God's. They're constantly reminded that when they have energy to work, it's energy that God has given, and thus they owe everything to God. And of course, when you come to the ultimate sense of who we are as image bearers, everything we are is dependent on God. We have life and breath and all things because of God. So there can possibly be no overreach for that domain which is God's. Which is why when you consider these equal, like my first kind of thought was, here's Caesar's domain and maybe God's is a little bit bigger. It makes it easy because you give your 10% or what is it now, 30% or so to Caesar, and you give your 10% to God. But you know, you didn't have to do that. You won't go to jail for that. So that seems even a little bit bigger. And then the rest is yours. I figured it out, kind of paid the dues. But when you start going in this way, you realize the hardest part of this challenge is not the first part, it's the second. It's not give to Caesar what is Caesar's. That's easy. Find an accountant, find a lawyer. They'll tell you what you owe. You have to pay it. But giving to God what is God's becomes incredibly much more challenging. And the way I thought about this when I couldn't sleep last night, I thought, if you put anything else in these blanks, it starts to really play out what's going on here. Give to the U.S. what is the U.S.'s? And give to God what is God's? Well, the U.S. is vastly smaller than God's domain. What we give to God and our allegiance to God and loyalty has to far exceed that. So if we cause our allegiance to God to be kind of a chaplain to or a supplement to our allegiance to the good old USA, we've lost sight of what we're being challenged to do here. Give to the UCC what is the UCC's, and give to God what is God's. Well, the UCC has some things that it demands of us. The U.S. has things it demands of us. I even thought as I was laying there, couldn't sleep, okay, who else can I think of? Give to the Pope. Give to the Pope. I love the Pope. I really do. So give to the Pope. And then I even thought there, you know, it's vastly inferior. We're talking about a whole nother realm when we say give to God, which is God's. I'm grateful after I wrestled with that I came across this quote by Lance Pape, because I think he puts it well, and hopefully this will benefit you as you wrestle with what Jesus is trying to say. Whatever we render under Caesar or to the offering basket at church, we can never afford to forget this. We belong entirely to God. We may divide our budget, but we must never divide our allegiance. The coin of our realm bears the image of dead presidents, but each of us bears another image. Our emperor, our king, our God is the one who said, let us make humankind in our image and according to our likeness. And what Lance is trying to say is, we're giving the coin that belongs to the realm because it's a coin with an image of Caesar, and it's the coin of that realm. It's how that realm functions. Its power comes from its wealth and how it spends that wealth on power and might and other things. But that's not where the coin of the realm exists for God's kingdom. It is the image bearers. There's something far more that we owe to God than we ever owe to any human institution, be it the greatest state or the worst. Which is why Jesus is ready to jump on their hypocrisy. He's ready to say, you know, your guys' problem, Pharisees and Herodians, is you're approaching God like you'd approach a tax gatherer. You're trying to figure this out in a way that's nice and tight, either or, yes or no, and feel good that either like the Pharisees, you oppose the state and you so reluctantly and with some anger turn over the coin, but then you give your coin to God and feel better and then do with the rest what you will. Or you, like the Herodians, graciously and wonderfully give over your coin to the Romans and then despise the religious folk that are just too narrow-minded to see that they're opposing what's their own good. Because you've put this dilemma up, this horns of a dilemma, and Jesus says, you guys have reduced this challenge to a place where you want yes or no, when there may be much more of a tension involved. There may be a greater need for discernment and wisdom and thinking about how God's realm overlaps and far exceeds the state's. So in light of that, that's the text, and you know, the end is check and mate. Verse 22, when they heard this, they were amazed, so they left him and went away. Because what can they do? He hasn't answered their question. He's exposed them as just so caught up in the system. They haven't thought twice about carrying an idol into the temple. They haven't thought twice about bringing this heretical coin that says Caesar's the Son of God and the high priest. They haven't thought twice about it. That's how immersed they are in the system, that they haven't in any way critically thought how that might be a problem. And he has bested them. He has pushed their false dichotomy away and said, it's a little bit more than that. It's not like there's state and then there's God and then there's you. It's far more complex than that. And so they go off, and I like to think somewhere Jesus must have said check and mate. Because he does this again and again, or drop the mic, or something like that. Because he's constantly getting these people, and they constantly come back. They think they're going to slip him up somewhere. That shows how much they hate him. No matter how much truth he says, they continue to oppose him. And of course, I think in our culture we do that to people that don't hold our positions. And we have nothing but hatred, and we can't ever think they'd ever be right, even though even a broken clock is right twice a day. And no matter what they say or what we do, we're still going to come back and oppose them. Even if they do something good, like Jesus just did and told the truth, they're going to leave enraged and say, we'll come back with another argument. There's no way you can be right. And it shows us how the challenge is oftentimes to put aside our own biases and perhaps really seek truth than having our own opinions affirmed once again. That leads me to a couple of reflections as we draw this to a close. This text, when you get right to the heart of it, is about God and government. How do you navigate the challenge of God and government? Government is a good, as far as I understand it. It's better to have government than to have anarchy. Some governments are better than others. I agree with Winston Churchill that democracy is the worst form of government there is, except for all the rest. I don't have an uncritical acceptance of any government because I think they all have major flaws and they all bring major problems. But they're all necessary. We need some kind of governmental system that in some way tries to support and nurture the common good. So that you're always going to have to wrestle with how does a Christian in faith, or for them a Jew in faith, interact and intersect with government? And in doing that, you're forced to kind of wrestle with all of the challenges of that. I'll throw this in just because I'm kind of off script as it is. As far as I can tell, there's only one form of government that really works. And that's a benevolent monarchy. And that's what we will get one day. Actually, we're already beginning to share in it. It's the reign of our Lord Jesus Christ. It is a truly good king, a truly righteous king, a truly just king. Not one that was elected. Sorry, democracy wasn't at work there. It was one that was appointed by God. So that's the only form of government that I see works. Now, even that may just be a metaphor of what we're looking forward to in the future. But it is to say it challenges all of our forms of government because we've seen monarchies and they are never benevolent. They always end up being opportunistic and lead to injustice. We've tried democracy and continue to, and we see the flaws, the holes, the challenges, some of the triumphs. We see all that comes there. Sometimes, you know, the majority is right. Sometimes the mob rules. I mean, you just never quite know. Where we're basing it all on the fact that we think people will do what's reasonable and right. So we are caught up in a system that we're trying to work as best we can. We always have to then bring our faith. How does faith intersect with this? And there are three major ways that Christians have done this, and two of them are the Pharisees and Herodians. One is you just simply say we live separate. You live a fundamentalist kind of life. Yeah, there's government out there, but I'm going to, as best I can, remain separate from it. I'm not going to try to influence it. I'm not going to even participate if I can help it because it's a tainted and spoiled system. At best, I'll just be opposed to it. So I'm just opposed to it. That's my stance. I'm opposed to it because none of them are good. And you try your best to keep that division of church and state as entrenched as you can because you would just like the state to not exist if possible. It's just a problem. It's a thorn. So it's the separatist view. The other view, and of course that's the Pharisees' view. They would have loved if Rome had turned tail and run and got out of their lives, and then they could have their own corrupt form of government. So separate. Then you have the Herodians. which is even just as dangerous. It's accommodate. It's the call to the faith to say, you know what? We can't beat the secular government we're in. People are secular. People don't care about faith or religion. So we'll just compromise. We'll accommodate. We'll try to be relevant. We'll lose all those elements of our faith that have any transcendence or any call to any kind of allegiance. And we'll just kind of be, you know, some pablum of a moral movement. You accommodate. And you just become one of them. You become that. You as... What was it in Star Trek? The Borg, you assimilate. And I can tell you, I read a lot of theologians, and there are plenty of progressive and liberal theologians that would just like to assimilate. You know, hey, everyone's secular, they can't believe in the resurrection, so we can't say stuff like that. So let's talk about, I don't know, fill in the blank. You just assimilate. You just conform. And that's not helpful either. So you can separate, you can accommodate, or you can do what I think is the call throughout the scriptures. And of course, this may not be the answer you'd land on, but I'm going to defend it as best I can. And you can seek to live as a faithful presence within so that you're not separate. You engage. You don't accommodate because your ultimate allegiance isn't to the state. You seek to be a faithful presence. You hold on to that which is precious, which is true, to that sense of I am ultimately loyal to the kingdom of Christ Jesus and the values that it presents, the call that it directs me toward. I'm committed to that. And when the state tries to oppose that or push me in other directions, I critically but respectfully disagree and maybe even protest. Because I have kingdom of God first. I swear my allegiance to the kingdom of Christ. That's the first allegiance. I don't leave under God to be a little phrase at the end. It is Christ kingdom. And then I wrestle with critically and also respectfully and also sometimes supportively. Like that's a good thing. It seems like that's a righteous and just thing. But being a faithful presence, as you can see, involves a lot of discernment. It involves not simply saying I'm a patriot or I'm not a patriot. Because Jesus was a patriot. Most people didn't think he was. It is to say there's a lot of space there in which to be patriotic. And it's not just my nation right or wrong. It is also sometimes my nation's wrong. And in that way, I sometimes have to critically yet respectfully engage because I'm called to be a good citizen too. I'm called to be someone that lives righteously and justly and peacefully. So I want to, as a good citizen, critically challenge. And when I can support, I want to also wholeheartedly support and pray for and be there so that you can see that last option involves a tension which our culture is not comfortable with. If it were, our radio waves and TV would not be so full of the 10% on both extremes that want to act like there's only a yes and no. Like that's the only place you can have it. You'd hear from the other 80% that have some variety. They have some diversity. They have some, you know, they've thought this out and they've worked through, well, it's sometimes this, sometimes that. It all depends. I have to work through this. Because those kind of answers that take more time, take more discernment, take more challenge, that demand that we treat people with respect and know just because they disagree with me or they're labeled as this, there may be truth still. It's not like they have no truth. No, that's demonizing my opponent, that they just are all evil. There must be something true. They're made in the image of God, for God's sake. So you have this reality and it's a tension that I think is a much harder tension to embody, and I think it's that tension which is in Jesus' phrase, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Engage, but engage critically, because you must give to God what is God's. And that's a far larger domain. It trumps Caesar's domain. So that one writer puts it this way, even if you believe as I do that secular governments have a legitimate purpose and therefore one should expect to pay taxes to support such a government, the government doesn't have our ultimate allegiance. Long before Constantine, that's the 4th century, Christians insisted that they were good citizens, but they could not worship Caesar. Which is why the earliest creed of the ancient church is two words, Kurios Christos. Christ is Lord or Emperor. Christ is King. Not Kurios Caesaris, which is the state's motto. Kurios Caesaris. Caesar is Lord. Caesar is King. It was in many ways a protest. It was in many ways saying, this is the world. We want the best for it. We're seeking its good. We want to live as good citizens. But at the heart of our proclamation is Kurios Christos, and that kingdom is first. And this is why the early church faced so much persecution. This is why they were killed and martyred. This is why they weren't just, you know, supporters of Caesar's empire as it was. They were oftentimes doing things that opposed Caesar's empire because they understood. We have to think about this, discern, pray. We'll fail sometimes. I think if you live in this tension we've been speaking about, you're going to fail. Sometimes you're going to side with the state, and a year or two later you're going to say, I shouldn't have sided. That was bad. I think some people that get involved in revolutions ought to have that kind of humility, because we all know there are revolutions that seem good, then they go bad. That you sometimes have to pull away and say, I failed. That was not, I don't think that was really the right way ahead. And so, you know, we got to rethink this. I've got to discern. I've got to pray. I've got to work through this. I've got to wrestle. I've got to talk to people who think differently. I've got to try to understand as best as I can how my faith will intersect with the state, with government, with the political system, and with life that we share in common. And many times in doing this, we'll live in a tension where we'll have all kinds of different views. But pray to God we never end up like the Pharisees and Herodians, where we end up united because we have a common enemy, Jesus the Lord, and we want to take him down by simply saying, yes or no, Jesus, are you conservative or not? Yes or no, Jesus, you progressive or not? Yes or no, Jesus, you in a democracy or are you socialist or not? God forbid that Jesus would ever become our enemy, because we'd want to place him on one of those poles. So I want to conclude with this. I thought this was a great way to end it. This is from David Uart. And it's our challenge too. How can a Jew be faithful and observant and also stay alive under Roman rule? That's our challenge too. How can a Christian be faithful and observant to the faith of the Christian tradition, to Jesus as Lord, and stay alive under the rule of empire, the rule in which we live? Yikes! That's my favorite answer. Yikes! That's a good question, because there's no easy answer. The answer is yikes. And then it's precisely this position of being caught in a bind of irreconcilable, conflicting obligations and duties that makes real life so interesting. The desire to make the tension go away, to solve it, is the enemy of true faithfulness. Living in the bind in the impossible possibility is how we stay alive and alert to the possibility for hypocrisy to be the way to be faithful. What he seems to be saying to me is that you can't remove the tension. You have to hold on to that tension, and when you hold on to it, you realize it's hard. It's hard to navigate. It's almost an impossible possibility. But only when I'm alive to how difficult it is to live as a faithful Christian under the reign or rule of whatever empire I am a part of, only then can I truly ask myself at times, have I been hypocritical? Am I carrying into the Church of Jesus Christ an idol of the state that I am willing to bow down to and say, this is more important than Jesus? And if I don't, I'll be called unpatriotic. Or if I do, I'm called unpatriotic. You know, where does our ultimate allegiance and loyalty lie? And that's why I think Jesus' answer is so nuanced, so full of provocation, because the last thing he wants is for any of us to end up simply with a yes or no. I think he all wants us to wrestle with, what does it mean to give God all that is God's? And that's a question we'll spend the rest of our life answering. Would you pray with me?